Do we think that's going now? What did, yes.
Which is as possible to find the number of interpretations.
Louise, sorry to be so naff. Does it count back? It's on an hour and counts back.
Where's Julie?
Julie, I need some technical advice here. Does this count back every hour? I just put it on and it's counting back for 50. You know, this second's going elapsing.
It's like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then maybe you have to reboot it an hour later. She told me that you could record for 3 hours at a time.
Okay, maybe the folders are an hour, yes, hour each. Okay, well, should I pause it again until we start again? Welcome back. We may as well begin because we're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, having been refreshed intellectually and materially. And I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Sarah Evans, who is CHEER's representative at the British Library, amongst many other accomplishments. Sarah is a sociologist whose thesis I had the good fortune to examine, so hence our connection that we wish to take forward. And she is just going to offer some thoughts to start us off in the afternoon about the two papers at this particular session. Sarah.
Hello everyone. Thanks for inviting me to do this. I wasn't really sure what a rapporteur was, so I've sort of cobbled together some ideas and hopefully they'll be maybe useful in the discussion this afternoon. Really, I've just got a few reflections and sort of connections to other issues, and I've tried to connect to some of the other issues that have come up in the other CHEER seminars, which I think some of you would have been to. I wanted to start by pointing towards some of the things that Kath's and Mike's papers made me think of when I read them the other day. And so I was thinking about the way that Kath and Mike have both pointed to the interconnections between literal and metaphorical learning spaces, and how they've raised questions about who gets to participate in the design and planning of literal spaces, and about how literal spaces can enable or disable metaphorical learning spaces. I was thinking that they both show that learning spaces must be created and recreated as part of a healthy university. And they've pointed to the ways in which thinking about space can raise questions about how universities respond to learning needs. It is working. I didn't know if this clicker thing would work or not. But before sort of continuing with this discussion about space in the academy, I wanted to sort of briefly return to the current context about the crisis in universities and the context in which teaching, learning and research takes place. And I know that these issues have been the subject of past CHEER seminars and have been widely addressed by its staff. But in particular, I wanted to point you towards something that I thought was very interesting that was noted to me on one of the mailing lists, which was... which is a map of the higher education strikes across the world. I don't know whether any of you received this as part of the Critical Geography mailing list. I've put the link up there, and I suppose if I go and click on it, it might open up, but the University of Sussex is actually on this map.
Not counted by Johnson.
I bet the internet's really slow.
The top of the league tables for
riots. Oh.
Now we should get some flags up soon. There we are.
Ooh!
And so someone's created this, and I just thought that this Fantastic. Was a really good example of a sort of virtual space, a shared space, for collaborative kind of struggle and sort of support and solidarity, and that this came across in a mailing list was really quite interesting, I thought. So Sussex is... Yeah, I think. So I just thought I'd point you towards that, something that I thought was quite interesting. Oops. And I'll send that link out to anyone who's interested. afterwards. I'll get back to where I am.
And the other thing that was interesting was the space between different groups of people within the university, because that, as I was sort of pointing to in Mike's talk earlier, it's something that I've experienced from a variety of positions, and I was thinking about this increasing space in some universities between the faculty members and the undergraduate students in particular, and the sort of postgraduate students who become a kind of go-between for these sorts of relationships and who are actually able to exist in different kinds of spaces. So then... I was talking to somebody I know who's an academic in sociology, and we were talking about different kinds of environments that we knew within the academy, and what was we thought of three particular examples, anecdotal evidence about what's happening within different spaces in higher education institutions across the UK. So I had these three examples that I wanted to sort of point you towards. You might recognise the institutions, or you may even be part of some of them, but I thought that they pointed towards some of the paradoxes and contradictions sort of inherent to prevailing attitudes about space in HEIs and about the relationships between the bodies who inhabit these spaces. So the first example is a new faculty building at Redbrick University, and I believe what's happened in this faculty building is that the spaces, there are no office spaces now for faculty staff. It's hot desks and it's open offices. And the idea behind this is to increase synergy and increase collaborative research and increase communication, supposedly, between academic staff members. But then at the same time, apparently, student access to the faculty building has been highly restricted, so undergraduate students aren't able to access this building freely. So I thought there's a bit of a paradox or contradiction there. You're talking about synergy and collaborative research. The second example is a new university building at Elite London University, which some of you may know. Now, this is another building where there's restricted access, highly restricted access to staff and students. Everybody has to show a pass when they enter the building. There are security staff sat at the main door, and everyone's pass gets checked. And the office, the faculty members have offices in this building, but one wall of each office is glass. So everybody can see what everybody else is doing the whole time. So that made me think of the panopticon and how surveillance is inherent across higher education institutions. And then the third example, a 1960s university in the southeast. Departmental or faculty members have offices in long corridors, and there are plenty of offices, they're quite small, long corridors with full length windows next to the doors, so the head of department can check if you're in there, if you're in work that day, and whether you're actually doing any work. But the academics and the staff members have reacted to this by putting up curtains or by plastering newspapers across the window, or anything they can get their hands on, really, to avoid this, to get away from others' eyes, to provide a space where they can think away from the eyes of others. So I thought that these three examples open up some questions about issues of privacy and security in university spaces, and they show up differences in who has access to spaces which are private and who has really highly controlled access to private spaces, and then again whose access to particular spaces is treated in some way as a threat. So for those students at that Redbrick higher education institution, the first one that I mentioned, their limited access to the faculty building may very well make them feel as though their presence somehow impedes the research process, because they're not supposed to be there. What does their presence do to research? So I thought that this kind of reaffirms this hierarchical difference within the university in terms of who has access to both literal and metaphorical spaces. And what's what makes people feel resentment about particular spaces and about particular others in the institution. So I thought this is quite different from the inclusive approach to research that's been taken in the Reinvention Centre at Warwick, or that the attempt at that sort of approach. Now, I wanted to turn briefly to a couple of examples from the research that I carried out, which I thought speak to this agenda or say something about space and power and class and gender. My research was with some working class girls in South East London who were all academically successful and who were in the process of making decisions about their applications to higher education institutions. They're all to be the first in their families to go into higher education. Some of them were expected to get high grades at A level and were encouraged to think about applying to Oxford or Cambridge. But as you can see, they had particular ideas about these spaces after visiting them. They went on visits to Cambridge and they went on visits to Oxford. And this is Fran talking about her feelings about Oxford University and why she wouldn't go there and what that space made her think of and what it represented. So she was really deterred from applying to Oxford because she saw it as a space in which patriarchal social relations were perpetuated. And this is this kind of theme continues in what Beth said. I'll just leave you to read that before I say anything. So I think in Beth's account, you see explicitly how architecture and decoration symbolise that this space is not one for her. And it shows to her an archaic world that's full of these illogical and unjustifiable power relationships. And she really felt the demarcation of difference is embodied in these in objects and interactions in this space. So I thought that these two accounts show how significant architecture, design, and its use is in symbolising ownership and foreignness of particular spaces, in particular spaces. And they point to how consideration of space and design is vital to the project of achieving equality and access to higher education institutions. It might be of interest to you, actually, that Beth did go to Warwick in the end. And she was drawn to Warwick by its art centre, because she went to study drama there. I'll skip through the next one, I'll linger on it maybe. I was just thinking of the connections to sociological research and other institutions, which show how women and many other minority groups are rendered invisible through architecture and decoration within particular spaces. And Linda McDowell's done research on spaces in merchant banks in the city, which I think is kind of relevant and applicable here. So I think as Kath and Mike have shown in their work, we see many factors which must be taken into account in our construction of spaces for teaching and learning. These three titles on this slide refer to three news or journal articles that were from March, actually, from this month that's just gone. And each, I think, points to the different and sometimes new demands which are placed on universities as a learning environment. I thought that this desire for distance learning and remote access to documents and remote access to teachers poses a particular problem in how to create virtual spaces which stimulate rather than dampen or just kind of manage learners' imaginations. But then at the same time, the imagination is not something which all learners want or desire or need to be stimulated or indeed expect to get stimulated at university. So I think the third title sort of points to how students are increasingly expecting that their university experience will be purely instrumental. It will increase their employability, their chances of getting a job, and so might not necessarily always welcome different or innovative ways, approaches to learning, because they might see it as something that they cannot necessarily market to potential employers. And if that again raises questions about the purpose of the university and the idea of the university. In an increasing student diversity, mature students, those from different ethnic and class backgrounds, different levels of disability. These will show up and bring up different needs from the learning space. So some students do desire conservative, traditional sort of spaces in which teaching takes place, perhaps, with a lecturer at the front of the lecture hall and students clustered in these tiny theatre-style seats. But others might hope for an innovative approach to learning, or maybe are looking for dialogue, access to different forms of material, different kinds of minds. And I think that this poses a particular challenge for universities in designing learning spaces to meet these expectations and needs, as Kath and Mike have both pointed out this morning. But it also shows us how promoting spaces which take students out of their comfort zone can work for teachers and students alike. And I was talking about this with Valerie and Louise at lunchtime, in terms of the discomfort that some students and academics feel with different kinds of material, different formats. We're all very comfortable now with electronic documents, with virtual access, with maybe not entering a library, with maybe not touching manuscripts or maps, or listening to all histories, or listening to voices. So not just discomfort around space, but discomfort around the kinds of interactions we have with different formats and different kinds of material. I think that feeds into this sort of process of thinking about how we might learn, or how we might respond to people's learning needs. How long have I spoken for?
About 12 minutes.
Well, I think I'll maybe not sort of go on too much then. The only other thing that I was going to point to was the connection, really, between time and space, and the issue of time here, because I think it's really us worth considering what we can do with the time that we've got, and how much time is spent on particular forms of teaching and learning, how much time is spent in particular spaces and in spaces we dislike or we feel discomfort in, or spaces we feel comfortable with, and how we feel maybe resentful, or we feel discomfort in entering new spaces, or whether there's potential in entering new space in terms of how it can affect our imagination. And Kath and I were talking briefly at the beginning of the day about how going into new spaces can allow you to do particular kinds of work or new ways of working. And she was maybe talking about coming to the library to do some work, you know, as a sort of, as another space in which to work. But I was thinking about time and how much time academics have and how much time students have. How much time students have to think, given that they're increasingly likely to be working in full-time or part-time jobs while they're studying full-time. And I think that for students, for undergraduate students in particular, that poses a very kind of unique and difficult problem in that having very little time means that you've got very little time to actually think or devote to learning, and the spaces that you have to learn are very limited. And I remember sitting in the student room trying to get on with work, and you know, there are people next door making noise, you've got everything that you own in this one little room and work time and rest time are muddled in this kind of uncomfortable space. And just to mention before I finish that the same is true to a certain extent for academics, this issue of time and space, the fact that academics have very little space in the institution, very little space to be quiet within the institution, and so increasingly try to undertake their productive work at home. And if they're lucky, they might have a home of their own, if they can afford one. But then, you know, this space doesn't necessarily always provide a quiet space. For a lot of women or academics, men or women with young children, the home is not necessarily a place where work can get done, or productive space. So for people with young children, they're the ones that are trying to undertake all of their academic work in the institution. People who maybe have older children, it becomes a spare room when their children have left, is a place where they can turn it into an office and maybe get their work done. So I was just thinking about these issues, because I think in other in some employment realms anyway, this sort of difficulty of negotiating work and living has been addressed, but it's one of those unspoken issues in academia. So I think I'll leave it there, and maybe we can open up the discussion.
Thank you very much, Sarah. That's very, very, very insightful. Thank you. Thank you. Mike, Kath, do you want to come back and engage?
I'll come back on one thing that I thought was a really important point, and probably neither of us explicitly addressed, which is the issue of time and the relationship between space and time. And perhaps just to say that just like I think there's a tendency to see space as a sort of container that's just there, as though it's somehow kind of natural and normal the way space is organised, and we need to problematise and disrupt that. We need to do the same with space, because the time, the way that time is organised is also not neutral or natural or unproblematic or, you know, beyond transformation. And so I think we need to be thinking at the same time about disrupting space and time, you know, at the same time we're playing around with space. That was really interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that.
What do you think we could do with that? Because the academic timetable is so rigid, isn't it? And the time that people have to go between, you know, when you're on campus and you finish 5 minutes early so that everybody can go to the next place.
But it doesn't have to be.
No.
And those are the other things that we can have some sort of say in. And there's a fantastic article. You know, I talked really briefly about those historians, Kathy Burke, doing their historical work. And one of the things that she talks about is a teacher at the turn of the century called Ted O'Neill, who ran a school in the north called Prestbury School. Mm. And he was a kind of real innovator and kind of ahead of his time. And in the day before the National Curriculum and Education Reform Act, where we had a lot of freedoms, and he completely reinvented this school, because the kids he's got were coming in from really poor homes where they didn't have beds to sleep in at night, and they'd get there in the morning and they'd be expected to sit there and learn mathematics. And instead he said, right, let's start again. Let's abolish the timetable, let's abolish the curriculum, we'll break apart all the furniture, we'll make beds, we'll do useful things. And so he completely messed up the space of the school, but he also threw out the timetable, and things took as long as they took.
Mm.
You know, and he talked about how kind of radical that was in school terms, to not have a demarcated, right, an hour, I've got to finish that, move on to the next thing. And I think that was reading that, and that happening so long ago, and it resonating with so many things we're trying to do now. I think it has to be possible to say it doesn't have to be this way. Let's find out how these processes come to pass and intervene in them.
Mm.
So I don't think it has to be a restriction.
Mm. And also, I was thinking about the sort of the idea that we have about students and the time that they spend in universities, because not everybody's making this linear transition through university or sees it as a sort of linear transition. And that idea of a linear transition is reflected in the way that teaching works in universities, isn't it? And the way that time works, or time is used in universities, I suppose. I was wondering if anybody had any sort of comments about that, that it's not always a linear transition or a linear idea of progress.
Yeah. Well, just to carry on what Kath was saying, and in the broad theme of what I was trying to make a point about, which I think you've added substance to, the notion of academicising how we think about the design of pedagogical spaces from other academic subject areas that might not seem to have very much to offer in the first instance to the design process. And I think you gave us three examples. I think to go back to the Virginia Woolf, A Room of One's Own, issue that we were talking about this morning, and learning from English literature how one can think about the academic experience of women, I think is very interesting. And then how one can generalise that into a whole academic research project, a house of one's own, is important. I think you were quite right to point out the relationship between time and space and spatiality. And we know from physics you simply can't talk about space on its own. You can only talk about there is only space and time, and yet we still talk about them in the design of the curricula at the university as if they exist independently.
Mm.
And they don't obviously exist independently. And if you put them together, then you get a curve.
Mm.
Then you get a curve. And one can't really think about the design of any any teaching learning environment without the concept of time. Indeed, what we did in the Reinvention Centre classroom, we used to run maybe longer sessions. So if I taught them then, I would teach for an hour, 3 hours. And it was important because A, it was quite a long way from everywhere else, and B, once you were there, an hour just didn't seem appropriate at all.
Mm.
It just seemed completely antithetical to what we're trying to do. And then the third thing that you introduced was the landscape, the painting by Salvador Dali, I think, which is another, we were talking about again this morning, another kind of landscape, to get a sense of the aesthetic from a critique of the landscape in the form of a landscape, and how much we can get from the history of art, what we think, and the theory that lies behind the history of art, to radicalise and subvert what we think a landscape might look like.
Mm. Thank you. Louise.
I'm also thinking about the teaching research nexus and how increasingly effectiveness is time defined. So, for example, the impact agenda in research, you have to demonstrate within 12 months what impact your research has had. So there's this very strong imperative now to make the knowable and the unreliable and the unruly and the non-linear knowable and rational and time identified. And it's very similar, I know Miriam's done work on this, with getting students to evaluate their learning, that they have to evaluate almost at the point of delivery the impact of their teaching. So there's no time for reflection, assimilation, disruption of processing the disruption. They have to know exactly the impact that it's had, and they have to produce these reflexive portfolios. Miriam and Sue said beautifully about this. So there's this very, very powerful momentum now to put a date on everything, and it's prescribed, and it's very homogenised. So all research has to have an impact within a year.
Mm.
All teachers, all students have to know what they've learned by the time they've left university. They have to package it up in a time-related way.
Mm. And it makes it very difficult to get anything wrong, or to be allowed to get anything wrong, doesn't it, as part of learning? Yeah, I think
it's absolute terror of mess and chaos.
Yeah.
You know, that everything has to be compacted and rational, linearised.
Mm.
I think connected to this also, I mean, I can't pull it apart, it's in the word momentum, it's the kind of logic of tempo.
Yes.
We can't have slow times, we can't have curved times, we can't have mess, we can't have unravelling, we can't have stopping, we can't have interruptions in that way. There's the imperative of knowability and transparency.
Mm.
And I think what it induces in learners, anxiety, but it's kind of like knowing is like that.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing is graspable, immediate, it's commodified, it's there. If only our teachers were clearer, the outcomes were more specific, we could get it. And that I'm not getting it, it's not my fault, it's not my obligation, my responsibility, it's the teacher to help me get it. So I think there's a real thinning out of the complexity of learning as uncertainty, and knowing sometimes and losing it, and knowing again and getting it, you know? And I just think that depletes the kind of imagination through which we think what knowledge is and what it could be and how we could distribute and engage it. So I think that this, you know, the tempo, time, space is very rich for thinking about.
Yes.
And gosh, it's not much there in the literature,
no.
But it's here in the room. And thank you very much for putting it there. Any other questions before we move to Gemma, who's going to have the rather onerous task, but she's the woman for it.
One place where it is theorised in higher education is for mature students.
Yep.
The different temporalities and off time events.
Yes, there is.
One place where it isn't theorised is around the international and the global.
Yes.
There's an assumption of a homogenised temporality, global one. And anybody doing international work, Diana's work on international students, know that you're working pedagogically and empirically with multiple temporalities in higher education, but it's always the dominant global north
that sets the tempo as well.
Greenwich Mean Time. Miriam, a point here before Gemma.
Well, I think Greenwich Mean Time is very interesting in terms of the meanness of the time.
Title of a paper coming on, I feel it.
But I was just reflecting on when you were talking about time in this way and the commodification of learning, how much more like schooling this has become. So what Americans call higher education is going to school system. And there is a schooling, it's very in that old theories about education, a schooling forms of regulation. And higher education has become all part of that same process now. It's not different as a space. And the other bit about time space is making the point about international students is also distance learning, or whether or not time and distance make any difference in forms of learning.
Sure.
So there are different ways in which people are thinking about learning. Which contradicts the other
point. A question from Diana?
A small comment, which the international student issue throws up, because the pictures and what we've been discussing didn't really comment about the background to the students. But quite a lot of international students get very concerned. I mean, most of the government's publications, edicts, behave as if all students were undergraduate students. Mm. They really don't differentiate between postgraduate students and how differently they feel about it, but also how international students feel differently about some of those divisions from home students.
Mm.
And research on doctoral students suggests that quite a lot of international students are very distressed when they find the extent to which they're expected to be in with undergraduate students, because they feel that they're losing the status they quite possibly have in their country of origin, where they may well be university staff themselves, and they find themselves, most student unions are aimed at undergraduate students, things that are run or of interest. Some of the wealthier universities manage to have postgraduate students, separate houses even, postgraduate students to meet, but many don't differentiate between doctoral students and certainly not master students and other students, and yet they feel that this is a severe loss of status, especially if they're expected to share accommodation or to be accommodated in the same buildings as students whose are quite different life phase and series of interests. So people have waited for years to have the opportunity to come to do a doctorate in a technically advanced society. They don't necessarily have that high opinion of our culture, they do have a fairly high views of its technological advance, but they then find themselves treated as if they were part of the same grouping. So when we throw in, when we had lots of Marxist sociology of education, happy days. mistakes about assuming that the class cultural background of students, but nowadays kind of almost got lost. Now, I'm sure it would be a joyful challenge today if they could share with their students.
Well, thanks very much, Diana. I'm going to move us on now, and thanks, Sarah, very much for a very provocative piece of rapporteurship, if that's the right word. It was really, really helpful and really added dimensions to our discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And last but not at all least,
but don't talk me up.
I know. My close friend and historical partner in crime, because we started life both at the Institute of Education, And Gemma has been attending intermittently our seminars, but intellectually and spiritually has been to every single one. And is going to just draw a few points together from the series and put that back into space, and we'll have some commentary on that. So thank you very much for agreeing to do this task. So over to yourself.
I'm going to stand here simply because if I sit over there I can't see my own slides, and then I won't have a clue what it is I'm talking about. So that's why I'm standing here. I'm not trying to sum up everything that's happened over the series, but I guess what I am trying to do is open up some themes for discussion. The series was called Imagining the University of the Future. And I guess what I really want to home in on is a contrast between the past and the future. And I'm still not clear if I quite got this right from what Mike was saying this morning, because a lot of what he's been talking about is imagining the future. But you had a little list of like the medieval, the industrial, and a kind of chronology. And that part of imagining the future, I think you said, is knowing the past. Yeah. So, in other words, we are not starting from ground zero here. So, part of what I'm going to do, bizarrely, because I'm not a historian, I'm not an HE specialist, is to look back to the past, but then try and use that as a way of gearing us towards the future. Now, one of the great themes for me that's come out of my partial attendance at these seminars is that often I think the literature on higher education is about other people. You know, it's a literature about how do we get those others in. It's widening participation. It's, you know, are we being democratic enough? Is our pedagogy good enough for somebody else? Whereas I think for me the really refreshing aspect of this series is it's not been about that at all. It's been about the collective. It's been about both students and also staff and what it means to be an academic at what I increasingly think is just a mad, mad time, actually. Somewhere in this little talk, whatever it is, I am going to come back to the metaphor of weaving. And weaving is about having a warp, that's the vertical threads, and then it's about putting in the weft, which makes the material hang together. Weaving in Greek mythology is also what the fates do, and each one of us, there are three fates. I was going to keep this to the end, I'm saying it at the beginning. There are three fates. One spins the thread, the other measures out the thread, and the final one snips the thread at the point at which your lifespan is reached. Now, if you put back in the notion of a cloth, it does strike me that in relation to the university, the warp threads are being snipped. That there's a kind of historical dislocation going on, but it's peculiar because there is no future there. So that there is not, it's not like we're leaving the past behind because we know what it is we want to do next. It's scissors are coming along and snipping the things that make sense of where we were in ways that I think are profoundly unsettling for people who are as old as I am. And I do now think of myself as old. I'm 56. It's old. I have lived a longish time and I've seen times and places and spaces that actually don't exist any longer. And that in itself, so maybe my reflections are partly generational. You know, that you get to a certain point in a generation and actually the past is slipping away. My parents' generation has gone, which has a deep contact back with an earlier history, and it's now only retrievable through me. And part of where we started off this morning was thinking about the oral history archive here at the British Library itself, which is a monument to collections from the past. So there are, I think, some profound dislocations going on. And if we look at the papers, I've just collected, well, first of all, I collected the themes from the seminars. And one of the things about them is that even when there aren't question marks at the end, there are a heck of a lot of questions implied. Where are we now and what are we doing? These are profound questions and it has been a profound space for thinking about them. Again, if we just look back on the papers that have been there, I particularly liked Kathleen Lynch's, I don't know how many people in the room were here for that one, Carelessness. In which she was talking about the carelessness of modern management, which both cares less, couldn't care less, and just kind of gets on and recklessly does and restructures, and at the same time the load of caring that then goes other places, so that the careless only get away with it because somebody else is doing all the caring for them. There was some that spoke very powerfully to me. And similarly, in the last seminar that I went to at Sussex, where somebody was talking about the shrieking of the women. Who was talking about the shrieking of the women? It was Miriam today. Well, it felt like shrieking of the women, actually. There was both papers from Valerie and also from Louise and also from Mary Evans, which really put women and women's ambiguous relationship to the university centre stage and how we're kind of struggling to make it make sense. Okay. I do think this is less about space and time in the abstract than it is about knowledge and about how knowledge connects to space and time, so that space and time follow on from. I am intrigued whether changing the space in Warwick changes how knowledge happens in that space. I'm also reminded of movements the other way. I look at a lot of primary school classrooms. They used to have areas. Every primary school classroom in the 70s had a bean bag. It had a soft carpet. It had a place where students could lie like that, and they've all gone. So they may have migrated into the university, but they've gone from schools. So what does that tell us? I'm just leaving the quote from Bernstein there. I think, well, there's Janet Newman in a book on new managerialism, which really sort of set out some of the scene around what's the change, what gets lost when we depart from bureau professionalism and we turn to the kind of managerialism that now runs our lives. And she characterises managerialism as being simultaneously open and closed. And again, that struck me in what we were saying this morning. Yeah, the future is both completely open, but it's also totally closed down by managerialism's absolute insistence on efficiency, on assessment, on outcomes. You can lounge on a beanbag, but you're still going to get assessed at the end of the course, and either you will pass or you will fail. So that there are some real kind of tensions here around open and closed. So the list you've got, I mean, I was writing this, as you'll have seen, just, I extemporised, like something dreadful, but I had these up in a talk I did at a conference, a couple of weeks ago, where the conference was on mobile learning, something about which I know absolutely nothing, and they really do mean learning with mobiles, and it was happening in Germany, and in Germany, truckers, lorry drivers, are expected to learn as part of their job, and they can now do learning on their mobile phones in their break times. So, but has that therefore, what does that change about how we think about knowledge, if that's where knowledge is going? You know, is it opening things up? Is it democratising things? Is it making use of a technology which is portable from one place to another? If you think about Oxford colleges, they are powerhouses of knowledge which are closed to the ordinary public. And they say that in a multitude of ways before you get into the hall and you see the raised dais. So are we against closure and for openness, which is the trucker in their break dialing up how to avoid backache on their mobile telephone and then kind of learning how to do it? Where does the future really lie? And it seems to me there are three kinds of places where the future is telling us that it's about. One is to do with compressions of time and space. And that came out very strongly from what Sarah was just saying. We also still hold to an ideal of flattening of knowledge hierarchies, and we imagine that the new kinds of technologies make knowledge hierarchies easier to flatten and that it's always a good thing. We've got a doctor sitting in the room, at some point we could do with some of those hierarchies which, keep mistakes constrained to the dummy and not the hive agent. So that when is a flattening of a knowledge hierarchy good and when is it actually simply unfortunate? The other thing that's hiding there is you know, if we flatten knowledge hierarchies in one place, have we flattened them everywhere? And actually, what we've also seen simultaneously is a re-emergence of absolute salaried hierarchies in universities, in which academics get to do less, control less of the space, less of the time, and somebody else increasingly thinks they can tell them what to do. Or my final point, is it something to do with the rise of the visual and the decline of written logics? I was very struck this morning with Polly Russell showing us the interface to the oral library. And I was thinking, all the money that's been spent on what could have been a list, an entirely written list, and instead we've got this huge visual display, the bowls of food and the rest of it. Now, on the one hand, that's a kind of invitation, you know, to kind of come on in, you know, don't get put off. It's a kind of flattening hierarchy move. But at the same time, what else has really gone on? What's the trade-off here? What's changed? What's stayed the same? Yeah, okay. So, here's me doing the past, all right? This is a 19th century historian. You can find his life story on Wikipedia. His name was Mandel Crichton. He's been extensively written about because his wife left a lot of information and a large sort of biographical trail. He's pictured here with his three daughters. This is the past, the geometry of the shot, its composition, everything about it. It does patriarchy, it does kind of gendered relations. It's not of our time. The quote from him, we won't kind of really bother with, you can read it or not in it, but it's him looking back to his past. We're now looking back to that as an absolutely remote past in terms of where we are. And so we can kind of bury it. We can set ourselves adrift from that past. It's everything that we are not. But actually, I've nicked this, and this is an unashamed bit of bricolage from a student who's just written me an assignment. This comes out of their secondary sources. They're quotes from the 1917, particularly if you read the first one. They're at the cusp of the 20th century, and it reads so modern in terms of the aspiration for what it is you'd want the working classes to have. There is not a politician who will stand on a stage now and say that. That learning is a good in and of itself. Now, we know also what comes with all of that, and that we know it's written out of a kind of confidence in a class position that actually educating the working class will educate them into that knowing their place. It will educate them into a kind of civility and a stable social order. So that's the closed bit, but yet at the same time it is a real invitation to know. It is not about employability. It is not about finding your niche in an economically driven world. By contrast, here's another little bit of bricolage raided off another presentation I've done. This is out there in the ethernet. It's a teacher, well, Jonesy blog is a teacher's blog, and the reason I bumped into this is because he'd written an evaluation that I'd done for the DCSF and posted on it. And having posted on it and said, well, I like this because, and kind of what about that from it, and other people should read it, then there's a little thread running on his page. So somebody else has got in touch with him because she's read. Now, this is knowledge making in a very new kind of a way. It's outside of the academy. It does bricolage, it raids down, it makes sense of those compressions of time and space that are represented in the net. You can bump into people you can't physically meet. You can ask them questions. You don't have to wait for them to stand on a podium to lecture to you. It represents all of those new kinds of things, and yet it can't substitute for what went before. It's different from what went before. I think partly maybe that's why we're all sort of stuck. We don't really know what to do with this kind of future yet. We haven't made up our minds, all right? Meanwhile, if that's the open, here's the close. This is just a very quick raid of Mandelson announcing his Hefke cuts. As he did in January, and how it was reported, and it's all about the economic imperatives, it's all about students as consumers, it's all about discipline in the academy. We don't really need to pay any more attention to that. So I'm going to end simply with Anne Oakley, and I I know there's a lot that could be said about Anne Oakley and what she's said about knowledge and how she's tried to intervene in a way into that debate about what should knowledge be in a potentially more open and democratic age. And there's much about her work that is very contradictory, but nevertheless, it still seems to me that what we should be trying to, it still encapsulates for me some important aspects of what it is that we should be trying to do, to develop the most reliable and democratic ways of knowing, both in order to bridge the gap between ourselves and others, and to ensure that those who intervene in other people's lives do so with the most benefit and the least harm. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much.
Stay put. 4 minutes of the recording left. I think we'll stop doing that. I mean, thank you very much for a sparkling set of insights and provocations about what the series has tried to create, the space, the time, a different tempo for. So, I mean, I really want to kind of open it up to people to kind of ask some questions, ask for elucidations, offer some more thoughts about. Sparkle back. Or do some rumination about, actually.
There's so much there, it's hard to know how much to engage with. It's so rich. I think the idea of open and closed is important.
Mm.
And I think the future is restricted or limited by where we are now. I think it's sort of madness to try and invent an alternative that lies outside where we are, or this is what we should be doing. This is why it's so important to have a historical context, to learn the lessons of history, which are that struggle achieves things, and those things are never forgotten, and the world is never the same again. Even though it might appear as if things have been recuperated, progress is made in the process. But it is limited, it's not completely open-ended, but it's not completely closed either. So I think the struggle, if that's what it is, about the progressive idea of knowledge creation in the university, is in the historical record and in the memory, and we should take a lot of hope from that. So I think that's important. It's neither open nor closed. It's neither determined completely, but it is determining. And that, therefore, it's not completely.
I mean, I think what's interesting to me is what is open when and what's closed when. Mm. So the open closed are probably a fundamental pairing, but what it is that's actually been opened up and what it is that's been closed down, I think we're sometimes less aware of that. And certainly one of the things that I do think around the widening participation is that there's been very good intentions around opening up, and yet some of that opening up has been bought at a price of really closing things down, so that the where you're, I mean, some of this in the break, we're having this kind of discussion anyway. I mean, I do feel very generational. You know, that there was, if you do look back to the 60s and 70s, the kind of the possibilities for pushing in a certain direction at that time, we thought it was hard, but actually, yeah, we were pushing in some respects at an open door. Things really were going our way. Whereas I think knowing how to push now that things, there's much more sort of reverse pressure coming back at us. For me, anyway, I need to think about that more.
Thanks very much. Any comments, Miriam?
Some of the people who were pushing were the same who are now closing down. So the generational thing is more complicated.
Oh, yeah.
If we look at our own personal conversation of knowledge, there doesn't need to be a public discussion, but those people in our generation were some of the forefront of pushing for change, emancipation, and so on. So there is a more complex question, sort of
just the binary of open closed, is a sort of continuum or three dimensional set of issues and changes, space and time fit there somewhere on all of that. I like the way you juxtapose ways of knowing, knowledge. Maybe it's actually